Good morning and welcome to our WAMC Roundtable panel for this Monday, the 22nd of July. It is a great pleasure to have you join us. Hope you all had a pleasant weekend. We're going to start off with our panel discussion, and we have some great issues to talk about today. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Newsman Ray Graff joins us. And our special guest today is Alice Green, the executive director of the Center for Law and Justice, adjunct professor at the University at Albany, who writes and lectures frequently on racism and criminal justice issues. Dr. Alice Green, a great pleasure to have you with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you for inviting me.
It is a great pleasure to have you here. So let us begin with what was the big story, of course, that broke late Friday. And what's interesting about the story, of course, is because of its, stories like this shouldn't break on a Friday afternoon in the middle of the summer, but this one did. And the president took to the Oval Office and spoke to reporters and said, made some very personal remarks regarding race, and ultimately, the big soundbite to come out of this was him saying, quote, "Trayvon Martin could have been me 35 years ago." And that moment, of course, punctuated a very turbulent week of protests and so forth. Let's hear the president's remarks in full.
But I did want to just talk a little bit about context and how people have responded to it and how people are feeling. When Trayvon Martin was first shot, I said that this could have been my son. Another way of saying that is Trayvon Martin could have been me 35 years ago. And when you think about why, in the African-American community at least, there's a lot of pain around what happened here, I think it's important to recognize that the African-American community is looking at this issue through a set of experiences and a history that that doesn't go away. There are very few African-American men in this country who haven't had the experience of being followed when they were shopping in a department store. That includes me. There are very, very few African-American men who haven't had the experience of walking across the street and hearing the locks click on the doors of cars. That happens to me, at least before I was a senator. There are very few African-Americans who haven't had the experience of getting on an elevator and a woman clutching her purse nervously and holding her breath until she had a chance to get off. That happens often. And I don't want to exaggerate this, but those sets of experiences inform how the African-American community interprets what happened one night in Florida. And it's inescapable for people to bring those experiences to bear.
The president's remarks from the press room of the White House on Friday afternoon. Alice Green, what do you make of the president's remarks and the timing of them?
Well, first of all, I'm very happy that he did make those remarks. I think the African-American community has been expecting and hoping for him to identify as a black male in this country, because we all know what that experience is like, whether you're male or female, but especially black males, constantly profiled, thought of and treated as if they were inherently criminal. And to have the president make these remarks at this particular time with the Trayvon Martin case, which everyone is thinking about and talking about and identifying with, was perfect timing. I think it needed to be said at this particular time.
It is. I found it interesting. There were members of the African-American community who said that it was too little too late.
Yes, I know people will say that, but I think we've never had a president be able to identify. And I think that psychologically it has great impact. We've been working with young black males since the court decision. We've gathered them in the community. We've talked to them. And Friday, we did a session even. And once they heard the president say, oh, that he's experienced the same thing, psychologically, it was a great uplift because it helped them understand even more clearly that this is the experience that we all have in common.
The president laid out several things in his remarks of several things that he felt could be done by us as a society to improve this problem and our culture. And one of the things, and he identified it as a long-term project and said, we need, and you mentioned this is why I'm bringing it up, but we need to spend some time in thinking about how we bolster and reinforce our African-American boys. And this is something that Michelle and I talk a lot about. There are a lot of kids out there who need help, who are getting a lot of negative reinforcement. And there is more that we can do to give them the sense that their country cares about them and values them and is willing to invest in them. How do you take that to the next step?
Yes, that's something we've been thinking about, we've been talking about for so long. What the president did was basically confirm what we have been saying for so long and the kinds of programming that we've been trying to do in our communities to help young black males. So from that respect, we appreciate it even more. But I think what we have to do in terms of helping young black males is to get rid of profiling, first of all, because that permeates their lives. And one of the things we want to start talking to our law enforcement people about is how can we do this? We've been talking about it for so long, but what do we need to do to make racial profiling illegal in our society? And I think that's where one of the places that we're going to certainly start. We also need to get our law enforcement people and other people who are in leadership positions in our institutions to do that soul searching that he also talks about, that we have to understand historically what has happened to black males, but also to get people to understand how their biases affect the decisions that they make regarding African-American males, whether it's stop and frisk on the street, whether it's in schools, wherever they are in contact with African-American males, they have to understand how their biases come into play. And I think that's going to be very, very important.
Alan, what were your thoughts on the remarks of the president?
Well, I think, first of all, I think that Alice speaks with great wisdom about this. I think it's a deep problem. I want to be careful about what I say here. But because post-slavery, we have oppressed folks who are black to the point where jobs are not available, where there's prejudice and all the rest, that we have almost forced a system in which our incarceration rate of blacks is so great and the rest of black males is so great that it becomes a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy in the whole thing. And I'm very, very worried because, you know, what will happen is the mayor of New York will point and the police commissioner will point to the fact that since this profiling has begun and stop and frisk, that the crime rate has gone down. Well, that is something when you offer the white middle class population that panacea, that they will say, good, then it's important that we do it and that we continue to do it. On the other hand, for anybody, for example, who's Jewish, as I am, and who remembers what the Nazis did and their profiling you know, of Jews. You say, okay, if it were me, how would I feel about this? And so I think Dr. Green speaks with great, great wisdom on this.
There was, there was something that the president said. I was really impressed by the language the president used. Obviously, very careful, because he did not condemn Mr. Zimmerman. He had great respect for the jury and of the trial. There was a moment, though, in his remarks, and he said, "For those of you who resist that idea that we should think about something like these stand your ground laws, I just ask people to consider if Trayvon Martin was of age and armed, could he have stood his ground on that sidewalk? And do we actually think that he would have been justified in shooting Mr. Zimmerman, who had followed him in a car, because he felt threatened? And if the answer to that question is at least ambiguous, it seems to me that we might want to examine those kinds of laws."
Yeah. Many people in the community picked up on that. We were talking about it yesterday. And they look at the situation. They find it unbelievable when they start thinking about it. Here is Trayvon Martin, who's a young black male who was not doing anything and was followed by a white male who ends up killing him. But yet Trayvon Martin comes across, at least in the trial, I think the prosecution tried to define him as some kind of a thug, as the defendant. Here he is we have a trial for Mr. Zimmerman, but yet we define Trayvon Martin as the aggressor, almost, and Mr. Zimmerman comes off as the victim. This would not have happened if the races were reversed, the colors were reversed. And I think people, this case is so important because I think it helps people to clearly understand what we've been talking about in terms of how the system treats us differently. And we find it very, very difficult to explain this to young people, but it's very clear, I think, to most adults is that something happened here differently than we would have expected it to happen.
There was a young woman, I believe, in Florida who used the stand your ground defense, and the African-American woman, the jury deliberated for less than an hour, and she was found guilty of murder.
Right. Again, they contrast those two situations and are really trying to understand what all of this means. And I think what the president says is that our experiences have been different, and we have these problems in the African-American community. No one's denying it, that we're dealing with issues of poverty and homelessness, unemployment, drugs, all of these problems. But what we haven't asked in this country is why? And I think he's trying to get us to think about historically how these situations were created, currently how racism plays a role in, the things that Al just mentioned before. And once we understand that, then we can hopefully embrace young black men who are victims. And I hate to use the word victims, but that's what it amounts to, are victims of all of these things that have happened historically to African-American people.
Alice Green, Alan Chartok, and Ray Graff make up our panel this morning. We welcome your input, roundtable@wamc.org, roundtable@wamc.org. We will continue our conversation after this short break.
Support for WAMC comes from Spot Coffee, Saratoga Springs, New York, a community-oriented cafe featuring fresh roasted coffee, baked goods, soup, salads, pizza, and more, spotcoffee.com. Menla Center for Health and Happiness and Mahasuka Spa, Phoenicia, presenting educational retreats for mind and body such as Tantric Inner Fire Retreat with Tulku Labsang, July 25th through the 29th, menlamountain.org. SPAC presenting Aspen Santa Fe Ballet, July 24th and 25th with Square Nun, Return to a Strange Land, Overglow, Stamping Ground, and more, This year, GE sponsors kids, and Citizens Bank sponsors students. SPAC.org for tickets. Support for WAMC comes from Skidmore College Master's Program, offering individualized graduate studies in a wide range of interdisciplinary fields. Masters at skidmore.edu. The Cymbrick, Bolton Landing, New York, presenting the operas of Giuseppe Verdi, and a studio talk with Barrymore L. Shearer, July 24th at 1:30 p.m. TheCymbrick.org. Vertex Sales and Design in the A&P Plaza, Pleasant Valley, New York, offering custom designs and installation of kitchens, bathrooms, and home renovations. A new kitchen in 7days.com.
Welcome back to our conversation this morning, our panel discussion. Alan Chartok is here, Ray Graff, and Alice Green, the executive director of the Center for Law and Justice. And it's a great pleasure to have her with us this morning. We are talking about the president's remarks on race and the Trayvon Martin case. There was an interesting one of the comments that the president wrapped up his remarks with, a final thought, that is difficult and challenging in this whole episode has been for a lot of people. I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. I don't mean that we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But when I talk to Malia and Sasha and I listen to their friends, and Michelle and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues, and that's true in every community that we visited all across the country. And I think that's interesting in two ways. One, making this an issue of talking about, of giving some positive news, but also talking about how much of a family issue this is for the president.
Yes, very much so. And I think that Mr. Obama and Michelle talk a lot about issues. I've had the pleasure of meeting both of them, and they're very impressive. They're very family-oriented. And I think she encourages them to do some things. I think the two speeches that he's made on race, I sense that Michelle had a lot of influence on him. I met Adam Frankel, who was his speechwriter, who was with him from the very beginning. And I asked him about the first speech that he did on race.
That was the Philadelphia speech?
The Philadelphia speech, yeah, in 2008, I think it was. And I said, there was something about that speech. You didn't write that, did you? He said, there are some things I can't write for the president. And we knew that that was one that we could not write. He had to write it himself. And I think he got some help from Michelle. This recent speech, again, as you know, we've heard that no one helped him write it. He came out there and he talked. He did not have a speech. And he when he speaks from his heart, I think he's also speaking about his family and the influence that they have on him. And I think Michelle plays a major role in that. So as a family, they do talk a lot and they understand what's happening with families across this nation, and particularly African-American families. So we're very fortunate to have them in those roles.
But, you know, it's very interesting, Joe and Alice, about the perception of change. I mean, we just saw this sea change in two major issues, immigration, sea change. All of a sudden, what had been assumed that Lou Dobbs and all his yelling hyenas and all the rest of the people were leading the people in a direction that we could never get out of, and all of a sudden, it changed. And also the whole concept of gay marriage and what was going on.
Right.
And when I talk to my kids, and the people that they teach, there is this major reorientation towards change that that my generation might not have been willing to do. And so I think you make a very good point, Joe.
Well, I'm curious as to, Alice, your reaction, because you started off by saying this is something that we've been talking about forever. This, yeah. We've been talking about this for so long.
Yeah.
So are you as optimistic? I mean, do you see things changing in some fundamental way that should make us optimistic? Because when we see the Supreme Court's vote on voting rights, when we see a case like this and a jury and this verdict, I don't know. Does it leave you optimistic?
Well, I think there are obviously some bumps along the way, and the recent Supreme Court decision was one. I have to remain optimistic. We work on these issues day after day after day, but the one that we feel strongest about in terms of the need for change is how we treat people in our criminal justice system, because the criminal justice system has been used for so long to control and destroy particularly African-American males, that we've got to make some headway there. One of the things that we're hoping to do is to get at least New York State to start thinking about having some kind of a truth, justice, and reconciliation commission. This is what we're starting to work on right now, so that we will be able to talk about these issues and find out and understand how the damage that we've done to people through our criminal justice system, so that we can begin the kind of reform that needs to happen. There have been some changes. I mean, when I look back at what was happening in my historical encyclopedia that tells me about how blacks were taken off the street and, ended up being convict labor simply because they're walking down the street. We've seen some changes, even though we still have the stop and frisk and all of those laws and the drug laws that have made such incredible impact on our communities. There are those in the community who want to work on these issues, and I think we're starting to see all across this country that people are working on this mass incarceration policy and calling for change in that. So there's some positive things in that there are more people who are working on these issues and are committed to change. But we have to do a whole lot more, particularly in that area of criminal justice.
One of the things that let's get specific for a moment of the one thing that has been called for. There were protests over the weekend. Al Sharpton held protests with Trayvon Martin's mother.
Mm-hmm.
There were protests here in Albany and throughout the throughout the country. Over 200, I believe. So in many of those protests calling for federal action, the president, while not dismissing that, certainly seemed to put it on the back burner, saying that, "I know that Eric Holder is reviewing what happened down there, but I think it's important for people to have some clear expectations here. Traditionally, these are issues of state and local government. The criminal code and law enforcement has traditionally done it at the state and local levels, not at the federal levels." Would you like to see Eric Holder move forward on this?
Well, see, I think hate crimes are very difficult to prosecute, so I wouldn't put all my energies and time into trying to do that. I would like to look at a bigger picture. I don't think, even though I think Trayvon Martin case is very important, it's allowed people to understand the big picture better, but I think we need to be focusing on how do we change some laws, how do we reform the system that we currently have, and how do we deal with the damage that we've already done to people who've been subjected to these horrible laws and treatment. So I'm not so sure that I would put that much energies into, because I think it's probably going to fail.
There's another dimension, Alice, here that I think is probably worthy of discussion, and that is, if you talk to some center-right segments of our population, and you talk about making things right, The last thing that that group wants is for pre-K for everybody, for example.
Exactly.
Or for health care for everybody, or for food stamps, just in order to have everybody, every kid, have decent nutrition. So it goes. It really goes to those things. There are some things I would think that are positive. Correct me if I'm wrong, because you're the expert on this, but our prison system has seen some diminishment in numbers, probably because of
economics, basically.
Yeah. Okay. Except that the people in the prisons who are running the prisons are objecting like crazy because this puts jobs in the criminal system at risk, and it's the last thing that they want had to happen. But just the fact that we're not collecting as many people in prison seems to me, because we know that blacks have a disproportionate numbers in that system, seems to me to be pretty healthy. No,
in terms of numbers,
yes.
Certainly, the numbers have been going down in many jurisdictions. But as you also suggest, it's due to the economics.
Sure.
That some states can no longer afford to incarcerate at the level that they were incarcerating. But I think many people believe that as our economy gets better, that we will see the numbers increase in those prisons. It's a big industry, and I think we have to look at it's one of the negative pieces of the capitalist system, that it also plays a major role, as well as racism, in how we treat people. And so if African-American males right now, because they've been in the position they're in, without the skills to take on different kinds of jobs, are no longer thought of as important in this society or valued. We don't need them anymore. We needed them at other periods of time in this country, but we don't. They're dispensable. We don't need them. So I think that unless we make some major reforms, you know, that we as a nation decides that mass incarceration is so destructive that we can no longer afford to do it, that we're still going, the numbers will go up as our economic system recuperates.
So let me give you a hard question. You catch somebody who has, you know, conked somebody over the head or who has robbed a store. We know what the chances are that somebody who has been pressed, economically deprived and pressed, is going to do that. What would you, Dr. Green, I mean, you are the expert on this. What would you do with that person when you catch them?
Okay. Because I understand what some of the dynamics are that might have contributed to this, rather than having that person warehoused in a big prison, I might want to work with that person, if I find it feasible, in a smaller group kind of setting, so that I can holistically approach this person, find out what their needs are, and how we might help meet those needs so that person become a functioning member of our society, rather than to throw this person away. And also to bring the person who's been victimized into the situation. So I think restorative justice is a model that we need to look at. You know, each side needs to understand what is happening here and how we can save this person rather than destroying him and his family.
Could you just help define for all of us restorative in this case?
Okay, the whole idea of restorative justice is that you allow the victim and the offender to come together so that they understand each other, how the offender perhaps has affected the victim or caused damage to the victim. And they come to understand each other and work out something that's mutually agreeable as to how this whole situation might be dealt with. You don't need to put somebody in prison. You might need for them to help you with something in your life that would make everybody whole again. Okay, so the whole idea is to restore and make people whole, and you can do that with both sides working with each other.
And that can't possibly be, I was really struck when you used the word industry. when it came to our criminal justice system of using the word industry.
Yes.
So what you're calling for cannot be more expensive.
No. It's not more expensive.
I mean, it seems easier and less expensive and perhaps, you know, and obviously more we'll have more positive results.
Right. And why it's difficult, because of the economic base that's there. We want to maintain this industry. So it's going to require a lot more effort on the part of communities.
How racially motivated is that industry?
Extremely racially motivated. That's where we get people to make this industry run. There's the raw material.
By demographics or by motive?
By demographics. It's been said that some jurisdictions can predict the size of their prison population simply by looking at the fourth grade population. This happens in Mississippi. You look and you see how many African-American males are in fourth grade, and then, 10, 12 years, you'll say, we will need this number of prison cells to accommodate them.
Does this come directly from KKK and from Reconstruction? I mean, could you plot what has happened here as a method of control?
Can you plot it? Yes, very definitely. And I think there's one of the things is Khalil Muhammad, who's has written a book called The Condemnation of Blackness, is very interesting because he looks historically at how we have used the criminal justice system to define African-Americans as inherently criminal. And so if you have X number of males, you can pretty much decide at one point how that's going to impact the criminal justice system.
You know, Alice, when the president was running the first time, he said something that made a lot of people sit up and take notice, somewhat self-critical, in that he said somebody asked him, one of the reporters asked him about the young males who were walking around with their underwear showing, and he said the brothers should pick up their pants. Mm-hmm. What did you make of what he did then?
Mm-hmm. Well, again, we have this discussion a lot. It's my sense that this is a fashion statement. I see it mainly as a fashion statement. But we also tell kids that even though this is what you are about right now, please understand that if you go to look for a job, you've got to probably wear different clothing because you're going to you have to present yourself in such a way that you don't allow people to discriminate you against you based simply on your clothing or even your color. But it's a fashion statement, and I don't I don't try to make people value the same things that I value. Okay, but I think it's just another way that we can stereotype and
yeah. But what do you think the president's motivation was in saying that?
Well, I mean, even Bill Cosby has come out very strongly on this about the language and the way the use of the language of the hip hop community coming into the vernacular of their speech. Also, the clothing and saying, okay, but at what point are you going to be responsible and do what is necessary to get yourself out of this position?
Right. Well, I think, unfortunately, a few people realize that it's been so hard for African-Americans to assimilate anyways into this society. I don't think it'll ever happen. But I also think that sometimes we try to placate white populations. You know, we try to say that responsibility lies on African Americans to do certain things that will allow them to take part in the society. But I think that's wrong. I reject it because I think African Americans have their own culture, their own ways of doing things, their own fashions, like any other group. But we understand the reality that if you're going to become a part of some of our society, that there's some things that you have to do in order to make that happen. So, I reject that from both Bill Cosby and the president, because I think that they're totally in denial of the differences that we have, and we should celebrate differences of different groups.
Don't you think it's both, though? Clearly, there's no question about the level of prejudice. On the other hand, if you want to mainstream people, you have to say, all right, when we are going to have pre-K. We are going to make sure that everybody can go to college if they want to.
Yes.
We're going to want that. That's our responsibility as a society. On the other hand, it seems to me it isn't one or the other. You can say to people, look, you've got to, up to now, we've kept you out. But now we want you in. If we really want you in, then we want you in. But one of the reasons that you do make that fashion statement is, hey, we're out of this anyway, so why don't...
Yeah, well, you're putting the responsibility on this person for the racism that exists in our society.
No, it's both.
Yeah, young white males, they wear the same, they've adopted some of this clothing as well.
And the music,
all of that, you know. And but yet, when they go look for a job, if they put on a suit, we're not going to discriminate against them.
Yeah.
So we tell our kids the same thing. You know, this is who you are, and celebrate it. But if you want to be included in this part of mainstream society, unfortunately, that's what you've got to do. So I don't think it's either or. But
there's a realism.
There's a realism factor here that we try to make sure kids understand.
Dr. Alice Green, I know you have to go, and I thank you very, very much for spending time with us this morning and for the last-minute nature of this and coming in and being with us. It's a great pleasure to have you here.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Can I just say that I sure hope you'll come back?
Thank you.
Often.
Okay.
And beyond this.
We'll give you a little more notice.
Yeah. Well, it is, it's newsy by nature, but thank you very much for doing this. Dr. Alice Green, of course, is the executive director of the Center for Law and Justice and an adjunct professor at the University at Albany and writes and lectures frequently on racism and criminal justice issues. Roundtable at WAMC.org to share your thoughts. Alan, Ray, and I will be back for more discussion on issues right after this short break. Welcome back to our roundtable panel. We have spent most of the morning talking about the president's remarks on race and Trayvon Martin this morning. So we still have a lot of issues to get to in a very short period of time. So it'll remind us a little bit of the of the fun drive when we do sprints.
Oh, yeah.
Sprints.
You do sprints. We'll talk about an issue and we'll talk about it real quick and then we'll move on.
Okay.
We always welcome your input, of course, roundtable at WAMC.org. That's right on our webpage. Also our Facebook page, or you can tweet us at WAMC Roundtable. We would love to hear what you have to say. And we will, if we get some of those in before we go, we will... share those with you. Let us talk about, we're speaking, of course, at great length about the president this morning. The president will be on the road. We'll be back really campaigning, a campaign-style tour of the Midwest this week to lay out his agenda for reinvigorating the nation's economy. Actually, an issue that has dogged him almost his entire presidency, and it is a major policy address that is expected on Wednesday, where he will address economic policy, and officials have declined to provide details of the president's message, but said that he would set his terms for what they expect will be another bruising battle with a Republican-controlled House over the nation's fiscal policies. Alan, at what point do you think we will be able to get a handle on the economic situation that we're currently in?
Well, it's interesting because, these economic conditions change, and they change for reasons we're not sure. But we do know that they come and they go, and I think we're on the upswing right now. So I think he's going to get credit for it. I mean, if things are better, the president will get credit, and if things get worse, he'll get blamed. So he's out there doing that. But the subtext here, Joe, is the fight for the Senate, which is very close. If you read Nate Silver last week, he came up with, and the Times is losing him, by the way. It's a terrible thing.
ESPN
of all places, because
still work for the Times too, won't he?
I don't know, but that's where he started, you know. And he's brilliant, and he's been right on virtually everything he says. But he sees the Senate as an absolute toss-up right now. And Cokie Roberts said much the same thing this morning, you know, on NPR. And there is going to be this fight. And if the Republicans, I'm sure that this is what the Democrats are thinking, can be painted as, you know, the guys who got us into this mess. And because, you know, the president has not been doing that a lot. In fact, he's been making peace with both Bushes. Yes.
I think you make a great point that this is what's coming up. And the New York Times makes a great point that this is going to be a very meticulously orchestrated tour to get his economic message across. But I think your point is really good about this being more about what's coming in the Senate, because word is this once again will be a broad stroke speech coming up on Wednesday, and he's hammering the very theme that was used in the last election, and that is by the Democrats: prosperous middle class, prosperous middle class, prosperous middle class. And so I think you're absolutely right.
You will not hear the word. I mean, I think the Democrats have finally learned that these elections are won or lost by the middle class. Those are the people who vote in the largest numbers. Those are the people who can either tie their fortunes to the people on the top, the Republicans, or the who have traditionally been, you know, sort of pro-business. You will not hear a lot about the poor. I think that is pure electoral politics. Mm.
I thought it was just a side note, but interesting that he'll be speaking at Knox College, a small private liberal arts college in rural Illinois. The Times points out, laden with symbolism, he spoke there as a senator in 2005 in what was his first major address in economic issues. So back we go. One of the other things I wanted to talk about this morning is Helen Thomas passed away. Yeah. 92 years old, was the dean of the White House press corps for many, many years. It is important to note of she was the longest serving White House journalist. The president said that not just the length of her tenure, but her fierce belief that our democracy works best when we ask tough questions and hold our leaders to account, put her in high esteem. And the president called her a true pioneer. And also, of course, this is a woman who's unfortunately her career ended in under a cloud of controversy.
Well, she said something not that smart.
Right.
Well, basically, you know, that the Israelis ought to go back where they came from,
right.
Which is to Poland or wherever else, and ignoring such things as the Holocaust and the rest of it. And it really cost her dearly. She apologized for it, of course. It was the end. And, you know, there were a lot of eyeballs that went up in the air and said, you know, this indicated that she wasn't thinking the way that she'd always thought. That's all.
Yeah. Well, 90 years old when she made the comments, and certainly had been in the business for a long time. But I don't think you can obviously take away what she had done and what she had accomplished as a woman, and in the press corps. And for those who don't remember, she for decades was the first question at every press conference. There was very much a policy, and she asked the first question
as well as ending it. Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. President.
The dean.
The dean of the of course, what was her? She started at UPI, right? And then
It was before it was UPI. It was the United Press, I think, at the time, and then whatever. I mean, I don't remember the whole thing, but I think what happened is that then it became UPI.
She began covering the White House for UPI when JFK became president in 1961 and was a fixture there until her retirement in 2010.
But you see, she had been working before the White House.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. Okay. And had been working, because I think she went back to, didn't she go back to Truman or Eisenhower that she was of different presidents she was covering, I believe, and obviously later went to Hearst News Service and then became a very outspoken syndicated columnist and not a not a journalist anymore.
Would you like a lozenge?
It has nothing to do with lozenge. It has to do with scrambled eggs going down the wrong pipe.
Ah. Thank you for sharing.
And what do I immediately think of?
Time for a break.
I didn't know you ate scrambled eggs.
Oh, well, that's
yes.
True.
We'll take a break. We'll be back. we'll wrap up with
interesting
some huge stories of the day. You're listening to the Roundtable on WAMC.
Hi, this is Lucas Willard in WAMC's Berkshire Bureau.
And I'm Paul Tuthill in the Pioneer Valley. Together, we have Western Massachusetts covered each day on WAMC.
From Berkshire and Franklin counties
to Hampshire, Hamden, and all of Worcester,
we bring you closer to the people and stories you care about most.
Western Massachusetts news on the air and online at WAMC.org.
I bring this up only because I feel like if we don't, then I don't know. It's being mentioned in every other major journalistic outlet in the world, and that, of course, is that Prince William's wife, Kate, is in labor.
Oh, boy.
In a private wing of a central London hospital, according to palace officials. A historic moment for the British monarchy. The couple's first child will become third in line for the British throne after Prince Charles. And
woman or man.
And should eventually become king or queen.
Well, that's exciting. I didn't know she was pregnant.
That's funny.
Yes, you did.
But it's got such universal appeal, doesn't it? I mean, you know, people have babies. And
they do.
There is thanks, Ray.
You some do. More than others.
You are correct, sir.
Yes. Yeah.
No. And people are really just so interested in it. You know, some people would dismiss it, but it is a universal theme. It's, you know, just a wonderful thing.
Yeah. Well, how much do you think? How much do you think of it is this are holding on to that idea of the monarchy?
A lot. Yeah. I mean, there are people who don't like monarchies, but it's such a constitutional monarchy at this point of the game that it is as important to Great Britain, I think, as some of the American institutions are to us.
And while there has been great discord with much of the royal family over the years and within the country, it seems that unlike those situations, people like Kate and
they do.
I mean, they like them.
And the mistakes that the royal family made with Diana, I think, to this point, we can really see that when the Queen finally got her act together with the Diana thing, and almost, I think, forcibly, yeah, had to come to grips with it. It was a big change. People now are in love with the monarchy again.
Ray is pointing to the clock, which means that we are out of time. He is doing his part.
Thank God.
So we welcome you to join us, roundtable at WAMC.org.
We got to go.
Thank you, Ray. Here we go.